Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to another FarmCon Conversations podcast. I'm co-host Todd Lefty with my good friend Kevin Van Trump in Kansas City. Kevin, good morning.
Hey, Todd. How are you?
Doing good, brother. Hey, we had some good conversations this week with some of our partners and stuff, and I say that in relationship to FarmCon. I want to always open up a little bit of FarmCon now. But we've been working on our messaging a little bit and had some key insights from Mitch Everson, Tom Willis and stuff, and just thought maybe it'd be cool to share, you know, and maybe some companies and folks can learn some things about how and why FarmCon is positioned differently. I'll let you start and I'll jump in.
Well, I mean, I don't know about if we're crazily positioned differently. I tried to make it a conference where, you know, people come and make their decisions. I know a lot of conferences, you know, get gimmicky and they got to have it down and by Disneyland or over in New Orleans or places that you want to go so you can take a vacation, because the content at the conference is a little fluffy, you know, and a lot of people go to those for networking. I got it, to network, to see a few things here and there, and to take a little vacation with the family. I positioned ours at the first of the year. It's in Kansas City. Who the hell wants to travel to Kansas City in the middle of the winter? But we thought it was the best location proximity-wise for a lot of people here in the Midwest, and it would make it easier for some of these business leaders and ag decision makers to come. And like I said, it's a place where I think some of our best and brightest in the industry come to make decisions, see a few new things, and to really do business. So it's a little bit unlike, Todd, what you're saying, some of the other conferences where it's just kind of all about the networking. They don't really do that much on the content. The content's kind of a little sus, and you know, and I always put out there, and I made this crystal clear to everyone years and years ago, I'm not going to ever have people at the show or at our conference that try to teach you or tell you how to farm. I just think the farming side is a little bit, you know, more of an art and a science based on your ground, your property, the slope, the soil. There's just so many variables, and it's I don't like going to conferences and hearing people, you know, tell me ways to do things or of that nature either. What we wanted to bring to the conference, Todd, is helping people make better decisions, better business decisions, better decisions about the farm, ways to make better decisions, ways to make some better agronomic decisions and have those things there and those tools as well. So that's really why you see we're calling FarmCon now the most important room in agriculture, just because we believe you have some of the most important business owners, producers, operators, ranchers in the room from around the United States. And you know, it's really been a blessing to have that and to be able to provide that kind of content that can help these folks that are at that high level. So that's why we, you know, we feel we're a little bit different. Your thoughts?
Well, no, I just got two things to add to that. I mean, you know, one of the things that's unique, and early on in my career with you, I'd hear things from people, because you've always been intentional. And this is to your point about what we're trying to teach. You've always been intentional about bringing people in from outside traditional ag. You know, people who understand brand building, investing, artificial intelligence, you know, all that stuff, technology, but how to scale businesses. And that's critical because, you know, there's a lot of self-talk in ag and going to the same meetings, having the same problems discussed at the same presentation. So that's a huge one, in my opinion, is that, you know, we're challenging their thinking by seeing how problems are solved outside of their own sphere. Then there's the other side is, you know, we talked to our good friend Mitch Everson from Meristem, and, you know, it took us a while maybe to learn, you know, how much that we have to actually coach some of these companies that will benefit there on what to do and the plays to call. And, you know, Mitch's big thing, you know, I spoke with him the other day, was simply that, you know, you got to get your mindset right. And once again, to your point, it's like, don't treat FarmCon like an old trade show, because it's not. We're not trying to duplicate that. We're doing something different. You know, and then obviously have a plan, bring the right people and stuff. But Mitch worked the crowd, and we're going to be releasing his interview to anyone that needs it. Might even put it out there online, just because you don't get an opportunity to put 800-plus decision-makers in one room for 2 days where things can get done like you do at FarmCon. So that's all I wanted to add there. So it's going to be another great show.
The whole crux is to try to become better business leaders and better at building businesses, because at the end of the day, that's what we're really all doing, whether it's we have a single farm entity or we have multi entities in the ag space. We're all trying to build various businesses, and that's really the skills that we're trying to hone in on at FarmCon. So, yeah, I think that's the
cool sense
of the farm. Yeah.
No, definitely. Good enough there. Well, let's dive into just let everybody know we're going to have later on here when Kevin and I finish with this, we're going to have Dan Maycock from Data Play and talk about some AI and practicality on the farm stuff. So kind of excited about that. But I'm ready to jump into corn, bean, and wheat if you are, my friend.
I am.
All right. Well, let me just start with this. Commentary and market insights shared by Kevin and our guests on this podcast are for educational and informational purposes only and do not constitute specific trading, hedging, or investing advice. Futures and options trading, futures and options trading involve significant risk, and listeners should consult with their professional advisors before making any final decisions. All right. Well, here's where I want to start, and you can just go where you – but here's – so we got WASDE on the 12th. We've had 2 weeks of, we'll just focus on corn, 2 weeks of degrading crop progress. I mean, the WASDE, from my understanding, WASDE data is going to end late July, like August 1, so it won't affect, it won't even have some of that in there. So are you expecting to see, you know, potentially the trade have a knee-jerk reaction on that report day when they come out and stay at 183 and everybody else is around them seeing the crops crash around them to a certain degree?
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, you're talking corn specifically.
Corn specifically, to start with.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I'm sitting here in my head thinking corn could pull back to 420, 440 area pretty damn easy. So I'm not, you know, I'm not nearly as bulled up as most people out there. I mean, I have a small bullish position on right now. I like some of the bull spreads a little bit, just because I think the carry, like I said today, the carry could evaporate I'm talking about being long D's, short March,
right,
or vice versa, the carry could evaporate if we get a bullish story, if so, you know, it's just all going to depend on how the USDA wants to play their hand and play their cards. I personally think we're lower, but as I said, I have a small bullish bet on in place, but I'm not sitting here, you know, with any delusion that we should be aggressively higher, that the crop's aggressively lower. I mean, to me, you're splitting hairs a little bit here. I mean, the USDA says we're 183, and people are saying we're at 180. Well, I mean, come on. I mean, you don't know if you're going to get that move. You're not going to get that tight. You know, the USDA, maybe they're going to cut a bushel. Maybe they don't. Maybe they leave it. Hell, maybe they raise. I can't see
why
it.
Okay, so my question is being framed from a potential decoupling by the trade from what the USDA's publishing, but let me just go to what the USDA is publishing. I know our default is this is what, you know, you got to trade the numbers, but how do you sit there and look at crop progress, do what it's done? And
I already told you again, I don't look at crop progress. I mean, why? I thought the USDA tells you not to really look at crop progress. I mean, they said it themselves. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I put out there, I agree with you. The crop, if you're going to, you know, if you're really making all these bets on the crop progress, I mean, quite a bit lower than last year in many of your big states. And so but again, that's why I told you one time, I said maybe 10 years ago, a couple of the bigger USDA guys thought, you know, they should get rid of that weekly report because it can't be super accurate at it. Like I said, a couple of guys in a truck driving around looking at some fields. I mean, let's be realistic. So I'm not sure that data should be out there either, is my opinion to some degree. And because it does get people all out of whack. And then the USDA comes out and leaves yields unchanged, and everybody's going to bitch and blow up. And that's what I'm saying. You got to be careful on that front.
Agreed. So
I've been burned on that many, many times through the years. And then I'm sitting there jumping up and down, screaming and crying. Well, nobody cares. Ain't nobody coming to save you. That's for damn sure. So, no, I don't know. That's what I'm saying. Todd, I caught and talked to people all over the place. I mean, there's some guys seeing some really great yields. I mean, you're not going to hear those people, obviously. Squeaky wheel always gets the grease. So if you're out there looking at Twitter, you're looking at other shit like that, I mean, you're only going to get the picks of the shitty fields mostly, the corn porn. It's very few that are putting out, you know, just record yield over here. Hey, record yield for over here. Nobody's putting that out there and saying that, really. So, you know, you're going to be skewed. Your bias is going to be skewed to the downside, or to be more bullish, and that's our tilt, and that's our position. So we got to sit in our head and say, oh, well, we're biased to the upside, and we're biased to the bullish side. So, yeah, I'm sitting here thinking the yield's got to be closer to 180, and I know you're saying sub-180. I don't know about that, but you're also out in the middle of the friggin' desert in western Nebraska. And I got it in your backyard. It's horrible. So that's been my contention, though, this year. I don't think we can be north of 183 just because some of these peripheral areas are not going to be nearly as good as they were last year. To me, that was those peripheral areas last year that really helped carry and bunch the yield to where it was. And like I said, I think the USDA could come out and trim last year's production to some degree, too. So,
well,
you know.
Talk about that, because I was going to – that was –
Yeah, I mean,
you got into my next question, but till you mentioned that, I mean, how much of a revision are you anticipating, and when do you and do you get a feeling for an expectation of when they might do that?
Well, it'd probably have to be after the next quarterly stocks report or somewhere
yeah.
in there,
yeah.
a little bit extended out. But I, you know, I don't know. I think you can trim 100, 200 bushels. I think they could adjust the yield a little bit lower and say, yeah, maybe we weren't as high as we thought we were. Some corn didn't produce quite as much as we thought we produced. I'm not saying it's going to be any huge number, but it may be enough to offset that feed and residual, little feed and residual debacle that may be out there pending still. And it may offset if they got to trim ethanol by 25, you know, million bushels. And let's say they trim feed and residual by 100, 150 million bushels. Well, then they could offset the yield and net-net. You know, there's the bears who are looking for that jump back up on a reduction in demand. That isn't going to happen. And then next thing, if they leave demand where it is and were to trim last year, well, hell no, you could be down closer to a 1.5 or lower ending stock number, and then we're on your way. But especially if you get that pullback in yield. I don't know. I just, like I said, I think it's going to be tricky here. I do think there's going to be some type of reduction in yield. I can see the USDA cutting a half, cutting a bushel, and it disappointing the bulls and the market breaking a little bit more off of that even. So, like I said, I'm going to go into August 12th report, holding a small position, fully prepared in my head, thinking that we could bust down sub 450, challenge that 420, 440 range where you get a lot more support. And then, you know, hell, I'd like to add and take a bigger bite there as a bull and see if we can't catch something later on. You know, so that's how I'm kind of playing it.
Well, my initial first question about the WASDE and stuff, I had a follow up because I was going to kind of ask you, hey man, if you did view that initial dip, if there was going to be a knee jerk reaction, and how that was going to affect your bull spread, can you lay out? I mean, you've touched on a few pieces of the puzzle, but you got this bull spread laid out there, and how's
well,
that going to play out? How do you
make sure you understand? I'm not just in bull spread. I mean, there
no,
are.
No, I know you're not, but I want to right
off. Some just straight up, and some, you know, but here, you know, And I'll flop out. It really isn't a trade. It's just more of a producer show. But as a trade, from a trader's perspective, you know, I'll play those options when I think the market's really volatile. So, like, say, in corn and beans right now, I'm holding bullish option positions. They bust this thing hard enough to the downside. I'll blow out of some of those options and just buy straight futures to try and catch the rebound back. So the options are safer ways for me to play a market, in my head at least, you know, it feels like a safe way because we've had a pretty substantial break here in the bean market, and I haven't gotten beaten up really at all. Just because, like I said, I was buying calls on that deeper break, and so really haven't felt a lot of pain. If I would have been in futures, it would have been a lot more painful, obviously. So that's what I'm saying. I'll play these options till I think maybe we settled or start to chop a little bit sideways, and then I'll flip back into some futures probably to play the upside.
Gotcha. All right, I'm moving on to soybeans. With the, you know, the price slide a little bit to that lower end of that $11 to $13 range that you talked about, and that's despite, you know, following some state condition ratings. So the question is the market pricing in the 53 bushel yield on August rain, or is it telling us that Chinese demand and South American competition are capping the market regardless of our yield?
Well, I think the market was overextended to the upside, in my opinion,
yeah.
No question. That's why I said 1240, 1260 range, start making
right.
sense. Got to be making sales in that area if you feel you were a little behind. We were 50% price. We felt we were in good position right there. The market broke, and we've broken about a buck. We're trading, you know, down here at the lower end of this 1170 range. And similar to corn, you know, I think there's a chance you could break this thing down into 1120, you know, sub 1150, be down 1120 range, which, you know, I know that's going to shake a lot of bulls out or some of these folks that had gotten in. But, you know, like I said, I think you're going to see the volatility here until these markets find their groove and find their direction. I've been excited to see the break because, like I told you a few I know podcasts before, I was hoping to be a sizable bull going into that, you know, Sep, October, Nov time frame in beans. But then the damn market took off the upside and was pressing that 1250 again. And I'm like, well, I missed my boat. I missed my opportunity again. But like I told you, in most demand-driven markets, here we are. The train has come back right to the station. So I'm waiting to be a bigger buyer. I'm holding, like I said, some small positions now, but I'd like to be a bigger buyer, sub 1150 in the 1120 area. And then, you know, maybe they press it to 1080, the bears, but I think there's going to be some opportunity in the back half of Q3 or Q4 to see a better pricing window for producers out there. So I like the demand story in beans still. I think it's a strong demand bull market still in place. Do I think you can see some volatility and extreme movement to drive down closer to $11? Yes, I definitely think that's possible. I still like being the buyer on the break. As a producer, I like holding off. And like I said, I like making sales at that upper end of the range, you know, in the north of 1240 area, 1250, and then closer to $13.
All right, so you just talked about demand a little bit. We pointed out in a report this week that, you know, June soybean crush was a bit weaker than anticipated, but the bean oil stocks climbed above 2 billion pounds. So my question is, if domestic crush renewable fuel demand are supposed to be the floor supporting this market, are those rising oil stocks a concern that we might be – the floor
no,
might be weak?
No, that's deep in the weed. No, I'm not even –
That's me, baby. Okay.
Yeah, no, I don't acknowledge that. I think over the course of time, I mean, I don't – the NOPA numbers, USDA numbers, I don't know. NOPA, do they have all the new crush capacity fully into the number? And there's a million ways you could debate it, massage that data. I believe wholeheartedly that our U.S. domestic crush demand is going to be strong. I think it is going to support the market to some degree to the downside. I shouldn't say to some degree. I think it is going to support it and provide a tailwind here. And I think, you know, I think it's going to be a real positive for the market. And I think it ratchets the bottom end, you know, that $8-$9 bean number that we had seen. I think it ratchets that a little higher just because I'm not sure it has the ability at this point to get down to those levels just because you're seeing the bidding by the new crush capacity.
Right. So, moving on to wheat, my friend, we noted that some major global importers are sitting on their hands right now, Egypt, Turkey, Southeast Asia, during the Northeast or the Northern Hemisphere harvest. And they're just kind of buying hand to mouth, but are they going to be waiting for you? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is, will U.S. export numbers look artificially weak in the short term and there'll be some upside here in Q3, Q4
No, I mean, I don't think they're artificially weak. I mean, I don't think they're weak. I mean, I think the U.S. export demand numbers are where they're at. Where they are is where they are. We're the ancillary supplier. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, we're not the cheapest place in town by any means. So I think people are just pausing here to see what happens with the Black Sea region and see how things turn out in Australia and Argentina, who are, you know, traditionally cheaper origins than we would be for some of those bigger buyers you were discussing. And so, you know, again, my positioning, I feel like in the wheat market, I think there could be a little bit of a longer-term bull story here with our ending stocks moving down where they've moved down to. The propensity of people not to really want to plant that many wheat acres. You know, maybe we get a little bump this year because you have the higher prices and you'll see a little more winter wheat acres thrown in the ground for insurance reasons and things of that nature. But, you know, I think there's some more serious damage being done in the Black Sea export space. And I think Europe's had a little bit of a tick back, you know, in their production. And so you may see some limited availability, as I said, the last few weeks. I think it's more – I don't really think there's a plot. I don't see a demand story as of yet. I don't really see a supply story other than the supply is out of position. Now, if that supply stays out of position for some extended period of time, there's a strong chance that you could see some more, some nice potential upside in the wheat market. I'm holding, again, a – small bullish position. Like I said, I think you got to expect some extreme volatility. I would be entertaining adding on a bigger break. I not really as bullish wheat as I would be, say, the beans on a bigger break, or maybe the corn on a bigger break. But, you know, I do think there's potential to the upside with all the fireworks and the, you know, and the bombs being tossed back and forth. So it's a war and weather story. And that's kind of just, that's kind of the damn theme, Todd, today across the board is it's war and weather, and the weather slightly improved overall for the U.S. The August rains were a little bit better, early August rains. The temps kind of broke a little bit. And, you know, you got to let a few more rains in the forecast. The war, Trump kind of hit the pause button in the Middle East. We didn't hear anything crazy come out of Russia or Ukraine in the last few days. So, you know, you just kind of walk those back a touch. And so bulls don't have anything new to really rally and attract new money flow. So, you know, we've kind of tapered them back. And I think that's probably what happens the next few weeks. You know, if we get a hotter weather forecast towards the back end of August and bombs start flying again in the Middle East and things, we get some more headlines out of Ukraine, you know, we run back to the upside. And if that doesn't happen, like I said, I think we keep drifting lower. And that's, you're going to flush out a lot of those war and weather bulls. And I think that's when you want to be a buyer. And I think there could be some newer things come pop up. But, you know, flushing out those war bulls and those weather bulls is what the market's probably doing at this point. And like I said, I'm going to sit here kind of patiently and just see if we continue to drift sideways slower. So
the last question I got for wheat is, I mean, you know, beyond the total crop size, quality seems to be shaping up as an issue for Europe and Argentina. So there's going to be a play for high-protein U.S. spring wheat that global?
Oh, probably. I mean, if you're a spread trader, yeah, I could see if you're a spread trader. I mean, the problem is with spreads anymore, just a little bit of it can be a dangerous sport just because with the funds, you never really know. So let's say you come out here and you buy spring over over soft red, or you buy hard red over Chicago soft red, and the next thing you're in a great, you know, you're thinking the higher protein is going to be the play, and all of a sudden some craziness happens, in more craziness happens in say Ukraine and Russia. Well, and the funds want to come in a big way and be a buyer, they're going to put it in the soft red market, and so the next thing you're sitting here wondering what the hell just happened. Well, the funds kind of readjusted, or the funds made a move and they did it in the soft red market, and you're sitting there short leg in soft red. That's why I wouldn't want to have a big position on, you know, in this type of environment, banking on the spread to pay off, just because, like I said, you just never know how the funds are going to reposition and move around, and you can get yourself kind of clipped up a little bit. So I see what you're saying. Yes, I hear that from a lot of people. But at the same time, I'm leery to get too much invested in the spread of higher protein over lower. So, yeah, just because of that.
Well, that's all. Is there anything else we need to say? Corn, bean, and wheat, that's on your mind? I got nothing else for you.
No, I think the market's given us hell of great potential, great opportunities to price some bushels and make some sales. I think some folks did and took advantage of that. Now, you know, here we are going to go into the back half, getting closer to harvest, going to have some harvest headwinds coming in. I think we could be pressured, and once we clear that, I think there's going to be some opportunities and some better pricing windows, I do believe, later on down the road. So, you know, I'm just trying to get in position ahead of that and see where we end up.
Perfect. Moving on to our macro section, we got the official jobs report coming out. Is labor going to be a swing factor now for the Fed, and meaning the weak job data going to matter more than inflation potentially, if there is weak job data?
You're the guy that thinks that they're just going to raise and keep raising. I mean, I don't think they raise. Like I said before, I think this World Cup thing, I think the big 250-year anniversary thing, I think a lot of that has helped provide some extra fuel to the fire as far as employment's concerned. I don't think we're seeing any massive layoffs. I mean, I think you could see a weaker jobs number, but what net, what is that? You know, I mean, maybe that keeps the Fed from being as hawkish as they could be. But at the same time, I just still don't see the Fed even being that hawkish. I mean, I'm sitting here right now. I mean, crude's trading $75. I mean, why does the Fed need to be all hawkish and crazy on a raise? I don't get that. I mean, what is the hot button? I mean, everyone says because of the war, well, hell, we're trading $75. I mean, it isn't like crude's gone nuts here.
I'm not. I think you should. I'm not. I don't think they should raise. I think they, you know, just from a debt payment standpoint, which I don't want to get into because I know how much you love debt, national debt.
No, you've been always on the inflation kick saying they need to raise because of the inflation.
Well, I've always said that they shouldn't raise. Or they can't. I've said they can't. I've said that, yes, but I've said they can't afford to raise because of their debt. But then the more I learn and study, I think I learned. I mean, hell, there's a chance they could try and raise and try and get out, you know, to lower the debt they own by raising the interest rates and making it cheaper to pay off. It's just, I don't know where it stands now. I don't know which way to go, but I don't see it being, I don't see labor going to be crushing enough to them having to lower rates and inflation.
I do eventually.
Yeah.
That's why I'm saying that the trade's sitting here right now looking for 1 to 2 rate hikes, 2 quarter-point hikes, the back end here of the year, 1 in September, 1 in Dece, and then maybe another hike in January. I'm not seeing that. I'm not looking for that. I don't think that's going to happen. I just don't. I think eventually, you know, we get into 2027, I think you're going to see some rate cuts. So, I mean, that's my thoughts. Maybe that plays
well,
but I think you're seeing about the top end of the rate range as far as the back end goes from the 30-year and the 10-year, and I think you're getting a little toppy, and now here you got the stock market back to, you know, new all-time high. So here we go.
Well, here's something and keep in mind, I'm a kindergartner in this space, but it just occurred to me today, and I started doing a little reading. But, you know, the difference, obviously, I'm not telling you that, you don't know, between, you know, demand-driven inflation and supply side, you know, pushing it up there. So it started making sense to me why they were calling stuff transitionary, because it wasn't a demand deal. And that's an easy way to raise rates and you can fix the demand-driven inflation is how I understand it. And when you got the supply side issue, you can't just raise rates necessarily. You can drive yourself into stagflation or recession. Is that a clear understanding of both sides, or did I get it wrong?
I'm not really understanding exactly what you're
saying. Well, I guess it hit me today when I started thinking about, are they going to raise rates this now? I'm like, I know they raise rates when, you know, demand-driven inflation, everybody's out there buying this and that. Well, that's not what's driving inflation up. It's the logistics. It's the supply side issues. And my understanding is
I know,
on the supply side.
You're the guy that hates the word transitory. I mean, that's what transitory means.
I got educated this morning.
That's what I'm trying to tell you. It's a blip in the radar, at least in my opinion.
Right.
I think AI in and of itself is going to be inherently deflationary. I don't think the inflation is the problem. That's what I said. Yes, I'm getting old, and I hate that everything out there feels like it's crazily more expensive. But from a data-driven standpoint, and if the Fed's going to be one of those, you know, we just look at the data, I don't see that you have a major inflationary problem at the moment. That's what I'm getting at. You got crude at $76. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, I guess you have some inflation because people are out spending money like hotcakes and spending money like wild, and that's, you know, it doesn't bother them to pay those inflated premiums. So I think companies are going to continue to charge it, right? I mean,
yeah.
I don't think they're going to back off the price of corn seed anytime soon, and if people are willing to pay it, they're going to charge it. I mean, it is what it is. So
I hear you.
And so I'm just saying I don't see it from a data standpoint that I think things are going to calm down by that September meeting, and it's going to be tough for the Fed, even the ones that are hawkish and want to raise. I think it's going to be tough for them to have the data to make them pull the trigger. I mean, I just think that's going to be a hard one for them. So,
and
you've got the back end. You already have the actual real rates moved higher that is kind of doing the job for the Fed. I mean,
right.
If real rates move higher, then the Fed doesn't necessarily have to raise their rate on the Fed bank rate. So, you know, net-net, I don't know. I'm just not sure I'm a big, big believer that the rates are going to go aggressively higher anytime soon here. So, I mean, that's my take on it.
So, regarding to Fed meetings, and they're talking about doing less of them, I mean, does fewer meetings make markets more vulnerable in your mind or not, especially if job and inflation, you know, start moving the wrong way? Is that an issue to you?
I don't know. I could argue both sides of that as well.
Right.
I think, you know, I could argue that it doesn't make them more volatile just because, like I said, with the USDA, when you got those weekly numbers coming out, you could end up tilting the trade one way or another,
right.
And then they get caught off guard in a big, bad way because of all those comments, you know, or all of that data. And so I think that's what Warsh is trying to say. We got a lot of Fed people out there talking and you know, putting out different philosophy, different things, all that. And then that gets the market leaning one direction. And then we actually, when the Fed gets together and meets, it comes back the other way. Well, then you could have more volatility because of the transparency. So I personally, in the opinion, I think they know what's best. And the people that are in place there, and I think they're probably going to make the best decision for what's best in this new world of media and, you know, Twitter and all this craziness where all this info is flying around and intel's flying around. So I think they see all the moving parts and pieces. And so I trust that they're probably going to do what's best for the overall, you know, movement of the markets and the government and everything else.
Yeah. So this next one's going to come in case we got a bunch of new listeners and stuff, which I think we do, but you know, you've said for a while, you remain conservative, avoid cash, prefer adding on the bigger breaks. Is that mostly because of valuation, crowded positioning, geopolitical risk, or rates, or what exactly?
Yeah, I'm a little bit nervous up here. You know what I'm saying? You know, just like in the used car business, I mean, I worked at a summer one time. I worked with this guy at a used car lot. You know, all the money was made on the buy, you know, and I'm in agreement, you know, a lot with that. It's where you get in, and we kind of wrote that in the market. It's where you get in. Based on a price valuation that becomes the most important. I mean, you could get into a great company, a great stock, but the wrong price valuation, well, you never make money in it. So, you know, I think the market's overcrowded. I think there's some things that are trading at the upper end of valuations, and that's where I'm hesitant to be aggressive. I think, I'm sitting here, I'm probably closer to 40% in cash than 30 now, and like I said, I'm using this rally here back to new highs to trim up some little things that I had floating around out there and just kind of trim down some stuff. And, you know, and that's where we're at. I think you just got to be a little cautious, and you're going to get those extreme moves and those extreme volatility. And that's when you have your list of 5, 10, 15 names that are your favorite companies, and you wait patiently. And then when that shakeout comes, you look to be a buyer.
So, one of the things we talked about this week, big tech earnings are, this was new to me, so we might talk about this for a second, but they're being inflated by gains in private AI-related investments, making profits look stronger than the operating business alone. I didn't know that really, so I kind of was reading that really carefully today, but when they're being driven, when tech's profits are being driven by, you know, paper markups and that's sending their stock prices up, what happens when those – I mean, what do you say to an investor how to prepare for that? Because I went and did some research, got some examples of how this played out when Amazon and Ford bought into Rivian back in 2021. And, you know, when Rivian price – when it blew up, they had to report it, and when it blew down – so there's big price swings. I mean, I didn't even know about that, reporting the private stuff as part of your operating income. So how do you play that area, man? How do you know if it's a trap or not?
Yeah, I don't know. You're talking about, yeah, I don't. I don't even know really what you're saying there. I don't know. Like I said, I'm holding about 10 or 15 companies, my favorite positions right now. I like Bungie down there on the break. It's trading at about 105, 106 bucks. I think they've got some good things happening. I like ADM on the little pullback. We've been long the Andersons for a while. John Deere's been a good stock for us. Ferrari's been a good stock as of late. Microsoft, Amazon was one of our biggies this last week and this month. And so, like I said, there's nothing fancy happening over here. We own Marvell for a while into the rally, and you know, and there's a handful of bigger. Eli Lilly obviously is another one that we like to buy on the breaks as of late. Goldman. So those have all been good companies, good solid plays. You know, I don't. Like Todd's saying, I don't know. I'm not getting – I'm just telling you, when the market's at this valuation and you're trading at 22, 23X and you've got this type of vol and you've got this type of market participation and things trading, I mean, I'm not running anything. There's no triple versus double versus, no flea flickers. I'm not looking at any goofy data. I'm not looking at any of this craziness that Todd's talking over there. I try to filter all of that out, and I'm only, like I said, I'm only looking at companies that I want to be in for the next 10 years, and all the data in the world can come out. Now, listen, some of those grain stocks, like I was talking about, the Bungies, the ADMs, and the Anderson, they're more cyclical. Now, those aren't stocks you just stay in and hold and look back. Now, maybe the Anderson's got a low float. Maybe it's a great stock to be in longer term. You know, 10 years from now, it's worth a ton more. But historically, Bungie or ADM will trade, you know, they'll trade in some various ranges. And, you know, when you're at this moment, I just think with grain dislocated or supplies dislocated globally, I'm a big proponent of the incumbents who are asset heavy are going to have an advantage on moving grain around and moving things around to areas that where it's cheap, to areas that then maybe it could be in tight supply and it's expensive, and they're going to make margin, they're going to make some money in those other ways. So that's what I'm saying. I think there is some dislocation in supply out there in a lot of places globally. I think your ADMs and your Bungies, Louis Dreyfus Cargill is going to be able to take advantage of that. And so that's my play there. And outside of that, you know, most of my longer term holdings, like I said, in the Amazons, Microsoft, however it may play out, we have a little bit of Boeing that's, you know, had a little rebound here this week. And it's just longer term plays in good, solid blue chip companies. And that's really all I'm looking at, Todd. So, I mean.
All right. Well, you add this one other weed question in there. We talked about floats yesterday, and you've discussed them before, but real quickly, go over how that floats factor in, a stock floats factor into your decision.
I just was looking. I took a small position in SpaceX in the kids and the grandkids' accounts and just threw money in there, you know, and we were in it, I don't know, 130, and then I bought in again at a little bit at like 108 or somewhere in there. But I think I'm in it at like 120 something. And, you know, it probably goes lower fair. Hell, I told Todd yesterday, the other day, how it wouldn't surprise me, went down to $50 at some point, just because I wasn't paying that much attention. And then when I went and looked, it's, hell, the float's like 13 billion bush, you know, total outstanding shares. And that's more than Amazon, more than Walmart has outstanding. And so, you know, you look at a stock, then you flip, turn the page. Let's look at a Casey's. We've held Casey's for a number of years, and I think the float on Casey's is like 35 million. And then you look at the Andersons, the float's, you know, similar, tight, not much stock out there available and shares in play. So that was kind of Chipotle's big story. You know, there was a super tight float, so any fund that needed to have Chipotle in their basket, you know, you're bidding up because there wasn't a lot. Well, then, you know, what did it split? 8, 10 for 1? I don't remember what it was. Same type of story with Tractor Supply. You know, we were long Tractor Supply for a number of years, and it was a really tight float. Then when they split, you know, the market, the stocks just underperformed massively. I think it was an 8 or 10 to 1 split as well. And now there's just a lot more stock out there available and in play. So, you know, my contention is, not as, you know, it's just not as scarce or tough to bid up for to get. So you look at a company like SpaceX, you have 13 billion float. It's like, it's going to struggle here early to move that needle a whole lot. Just because you got the lockups coming, or, you know, where these people are able to sell, you got 20% additional coming in. You'll have another 28% at the end of the third quarter. So, you know, I just say, the best of all worlds, if you get a really hot company or hot stock, obviously with a small float, you got a lot better chance for explosive growth to the upside in that stock. So it is something to consider, something to look at. But it isn't like any golden rule or anything like that.
Appreciate that. Hey, we reported, you know, we're seeing these prediction markets continue to hit highs. They hit an all-time high in July. The question is, I mean, we touched on it before, but do you see this as a legitimate new market structure, or just another way people are being pulled into gambling with better technology?
Yeah, no, there's no question. I think this is going to be a lot. I think it's here to stay, and I think it's going to be huge, and it looks like it's going to explode. I'm kind of kicking myself because I just don't know much about it. I haven't participated in any real way, shape, or form as of yet, except as a spectator, you know, on the side trying to figure it out and just kind of watch and see how the things move. But, no, I think it's definitely the way of the future. We're going to have Cauchy. We're going to have, you know, a couple of those at FarmCon coming up, the folks that are leading those companies. And I'm excited to learn more because they're going to, you know, they're making bigger strides and taking bigger steps into the ag world and into commodities, you know. So you'll be able to have prediction markets on corn and beans and wheat and, you know, where this corn yield, you know, we'll be able to really see, Todd, what big money is being put on this corn yield and what people are saying. And so I think that would be good. Like I said, I've heard of a couple of weather forecasters pulling some big money out on weather predicting. You know, maybe Gary Lezak needs to look into that. Gary maybe needs to look into that with these prediction markets. Because, you know, you can make bets on, is it going to rain today here at this location? Is it going to rain over here and here? You know, what will the temperature be? You know, so there's all kinds of things. And why it's so much better than polls, you know, polling's just been horrendous as of the last decade, just in and of itself, because people are actually putting real money and making real bets on their opinion. So I think it is more accurate. I think you can also, I like to look at it just to see what its subjects are being bet on. So then I know what's out there that is actually having some relevance and moving the market. So I like to look at it from that aspect too. So I see a lot of, you know, I don't know and understand a lot of it. So it kind of, I don't know if it scares me necessarily, but I feel stupid about it. But I do think it is going to be sticky, and I think it's going to be probably the way things move in the future. So
does this then, as a businessman, somebody who builds real businesses, I mean, is this at all a concern for quietly draining capital out of a productive economy? I mean, since it's a zero-sum game and everything under the sun you can bet on?
And if it continues to grow? It is another factor that makes me somewhat a bit nervousy about the stock market, just meaning that there are many, many alternative places. That's the thing. So with SpaceX coming on board, okay, that took a lot of money from other stocks. Now, when you bring Anthropic and OpenAI and some of these other, that takes a lot of money out of some of these other stocks. So I'm of the, you know, I'm of the belief that you just got to be a little careful here because it's all about money flow. And, you know, as that ebbs and flows and these other ancillary, you know, asset classes are created or these other assets are brought into the market, I think you could see some, you know, air pockets there where you're going to get some big ups and some big downs, just like we've seen this last week or week and a half here. So,
all right, one more topic before we bring Dan Maycock on. In yesterday's story three, you're a sucker for a good story. How it's impacted your investing stuff. And we talked about it a little bit, but I think it's such an important point to revisit how, from an investor standpoint, especially somebody that's younger, newer, getting into VC maybe, talk about the story, you know, Howard Marks' quote today was spot on, and then the story that you wrote, just your perspective on story versus knowing the reality behind the scene for investing.
Well, like I said, I've always been a big, you know, story guy. And when someone tells me a great story, I'm all excited, and especially if it's a story I haven't heard before. And, you know, I was approached a ton when I was younger and started out trading in Chicago and other places, you know, with people would come to me with an idea, you know, hey, have you heard about this company? Have you heard about this penny stock? Have you heard about this biotech? You know, they're healing kids with this illness, or they're healing animals and pets with this illness, and they're doing this, and, you know, it's all great stories, and it's like, man, that's awesome. I want to be involved in that. That could be the next, you know, thing that changes the world. Well, shit, I mean, that, you know, those are a dime a dozen, and, you know, I would race in there and throw money in, come home, tell Michelle, you know, hey, we're going to, you know, I was probably out spending money before I even ever even thought about having it made, and, you know, and then one thing after another led to another, and it's capital call check after capital call. And then, you know, you're just in a huge hole and a huge losing position. And there were plenty of times, even in the open market, I can remember trading WorldCom. I can remember trading Payless Cashways. Both of those stocks, I traded literally to zero, and I cost averaged into them multiple times.
Attaboy.
I, you know, thought the market was going to bounce, thought I knew something that I didn't, and, you know, got just totally got my ass handed to me. And that, those are some public companies. I could go through a whole list. I mean, I could get out a list of about probably a mile long of private companies that I've bought into through the years based on a story, based on, you know, I thought it was great, you know, my, again, a great story. And it didn't play out. It didn't come to fruition. So as my buddy Dave Kremholtz, only one, you know, he's a big-time CEO at a lot of, you know, everybody's got an opinion when you come into the boardroom, but the numbers just simply don't lie. And the numbers tend to squash people's opinions, and it's the truth. And that's why I've always been a big proponent. Ty, whenever you and I get into a conversation, I just say, hey, look at the scoreboard. Decide what your scoreboard is.
Yeah,
and look at
every
it.
Time.
And it doesn't matter. That's why I'm like, I don't even want to hear people's opinions. I just tell you to go, here, what is it you're trying to gauge out? And then that becomes your scoreboard. You know, are you gauging revenue? Are you gauging new customer acquisition? Are you gauging customer retention? Are you gauging profitability? Are you gauging market share? Whatever it is you're trying to gauge. And I'll say, okay, well, then that becomes your scoreboard now. And then how did you perform and move toward, you know? And most of the time it puts a real crimp in the boardroom when you start to talk numbers. Data and all everybody sitting around has got opinions about how we're going to grow or how we're going to do this, but when you look at the numbers, they don't lie. And you know, and that's all I'm trying to say is that, you know, it's like SpaceX, man, what a great story, right? Just a great story. And you're seeing all the satellites out there, you're seeing everything else, and it is a great story. And you got Elon Musk at the helm, and you got a lot of great ingredients in that story. But when you really lift up and look under the hood, you know, you got crazy number of shares in float. You have really, you know, you're in the hole. I mean, you're not making any money, so to speak, as of yet. You're not profitable. And there's just a lot of reasons that you could conclude to not own the stock, right? There's just a ton of, you know, really smart investors that could show you a million real data points on why it'd be foolish to be a buyer at this price. And I would concur. But I'm a trader and I'm an investor, a longer-term investor, so I got to try and build a position at some point. I think longer-term the stock has some validity. I think longer-term, my opinion is you're going to see some of the incumbents, whether it's Amazon. I really love Amazon's positioning here, especially with Bezos launching some of the low orbit satellites. I think Amazon's got themselves in a position logistically to do some major things. I think eventually SpaceX probably gobbles up Tesla. They're going to be logistically a real tough player as well as SpaceX and Tesla combine and create some things. So I'm just trying to build a position into that. And I got all the reasons not to be long SpaceX. I got them in spades. But as an investor and trader, this is how I invest and trade. I build positions into the breaks, and that's really what I'm doing at this point in time. So, you know, here we are. Yeah, and those are ways you play it with. And like I said, data. It's all about the numbers and the data, and you really do need to be more diligent to look at that stuff. But it's tough to avoid a sexy story, right? I mean, it gets you every time, and it's definitely takes discipline not to bite, so.
It does. You just used the word data. What a perfect segue. Let me Dan Maycock, are you on with us, sir? I'll let you get a chance to unmute.
Yes, I am.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Glad you could be here. Let me do a quick. We're going to switch over and let me introduce you, and then we'll get rolling. Dan Maycock is the co-founder and CTO of DataPlay, an AI and data consulting firm for agriculture and food industries. He was raised in a farming town, and he pairs his hands-on agricultural knowledge with more than two decades of enterprise technology and data experience to build AI platforms that turn data farms already generate from equipment telemetry to satellite imagery into better decisions. Dan, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you're welcome. It's a perfect week. We ran a good story on Monday about AI and stuff. I don't know if you had a chance to see it or not, but we're going to talk about some of the same stuff as we go. So before we get into that, and tell farmers what all this means. Tell us a little bit about your background. What led you to start Data data play and what problems you believed needed to be solved in agriculture with that.
Absolutely. So grew up in a small town in eastern Washington, a Prosser, where I'd say my mom was a teacher, my dad was a pastor, and everyone else was a farmer. So grew up right away working with a lot of friends in farming. First job at 13 was actually working for a local computer store where wheat farmers from Horse Heaven Hills would come down and buy computers in the early 90s to start to help solve some of these issues around weather data and whatever else. So cut my teeth early and worked in cherries, worked in apples, went to Washington State University, worked in the ag school there, and then pivoted to high tech. So work for companies like Boeing and Amazon in Seattle, and then found my way back into agriculture after a number of years and took all that back into farming. In Yakima, Washington, was the CIO of a large farm, started a fractional data company with a hop farmer, and really saw the huge opportunity to take all that expertise I had in the high-tech space, bring it back into farming, and started Data Play 7 years later with my wife. And now we do AI and data solutions for ag companies all over the world, taking the marketing gimmicks and the snake oil and the science projects out of it and building stuff for farmers that really drives the needle and helps folks save money.
All right, so you said some key things here that I think that we're going to try and flesh out here and make sense out of, because, you know, I tell people now when I say the word AI, use that in a sense, or people use it in a sense, it's the same, has the same sense of when regenerative ag is used, meaning it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. What I'd like you to do is, because we've been putting some stories out there, we're talking about it, I want you to lay out what the realities are, what the real world value is and stuff. So if you were sitting at a kitchen table with a farmer who keeps hearing about AI, doesn't understand what it is yet or why it matters, how would you explain what is happening, where the real value is, and what he should be doing right now?
Absolutely. So AI as a term has been around a long time. We're not talking artificial insemination here. But AI as a traditional ag tech tool is a lot around image recognition. So I point a camera at a weed, identifies what kind of weed it is. That technology has been around and continued to mature for a long time. We'll call that traditional AI. And then when this new phase of AI, generative AI, where it's all about using tools like OpenAI, ChatGPT, Claude, Grok, around. I submit questions, I get answers, and that's what we're hearing about in the news today. And that's kind of the new version of AI. And it really comes down to a model that's able to process a lot of information and use reasoning and statistics and a whole bunch of science to help drive better decisions by sorting through a lot of information and surfacing what matters. And the application for agriculture is really that we're all, I would say, in an ocean of data, but we're all dying of thirst, and that a lot of farms have had a lot of data for a long time. Putting that to work has been very difficult, and there's no shortage of apps on farmers' phones that do different parts of that, building point solutions, all these ag tech technologies that have been around a while. We see a lot of information around putting John Deere Ops Center data to work, or information around labor management if you're, you know, a specialty crop grower. But it's all about, for me at the end of the day, if I'm at that kitchen table as a farmer, I call it the 2 a.m. problem, where 2 a.m., I'm sitting there and, you know, everyone's asleep and I have problems. I'm staring at a piece of paper I got to solve just to keep the farm going. And that's where all the gimmicks and tech and everything else kind of go out the window. And it's just about, can I make better decisions and get the answers with what's in front of me? And everything else is kind of secondary to that. And a large part, AI sounds really impressive. And there's a lot of cool stuff going on. But if it doesn't solve that 2 a.m. problem for a farmer, doesn't do a whole lot of good. And there's different parts to that, from having really good data in the first place, not so much having more of it, but having it organized in a way that it's accessible, using the right tools, and not necessarily paying a fortune for it to get good insights out, and then biting off smaller problems, work your way up to the more more hairy stuff, right? We're not talking moonshots here. It's about diesel prices, it's about labor management, it's about decisions I make on a daily basis, and like compound interest, those things add up over time versus like, hey, we're going to optimize and get you 10% more bushels per acre. It's more about, I see places I'm spending money each and every day or along the way. That adds up to bigger numbers over time. How do I attack that? And that's where I think we see a lot of the early wins going is not really crazy stuff, but more small things that add up over time.
So practically speaking, though, you described the process and you touched on, I was going to ask you about data and the, you know, having it, but what the mechanics behind it? I mean, what are we telling a farmer need to do? I mean, obviously, I know you're making a platform, you're making a place with all that data to funnel into. I mean, at the end of the day, when we say AI, that's what we're talking about. It's creating this place for all this siloed data to fold into to make these better decisions. Is that correct?
Yeah, we talk about it in terms of what's called a data warehouse, which is basically something on your farm, on premise, something in the cloud if I'm hosting it, where all that data goes and lives. And there's a lot of great tools and resources out now getting that built and set up. You don't necessarily need all your farm data to get going. We work with some farmers that are just looking at, say, Conservice or John Deere Ops data to start. That gets you pretty far, or QuickBooks data, for example. You know, if a farmer doesn't have a full-time controller or a CFO, how do I get a better handle on financial decisions? There's certainly a lot of great resources out there, too. But once again, the benefit of these AI tools is something a farmer can own and work on themselves. It's not something that you got to pay me necessarily to do, or, you know, a lot of stuff off the shelf, but it's more, I want to bring a tool in to my farm to operate as a member of my team to help me make decisions about all the data I already have in front of me. I don't necessarily want to set up a bunch of infrastructure or buy a lot of stuff if I don't have to, but I need to see the benefit of that pretty quick. And so getting all the data on your farm means you don't have 13 apps to log into. That's a great end goal. But finding one or two data sources to start, or Excel files, or, you know, whatever's in front of you, kind of causing the most heartache to begin with, that's a great place to start when it comes to getting going with these AI tools.
So I asked you when we spoke a while back, you know, when Kevin and I talked about this, one of his big things is, you know, no one's yet to show him the value play for the farmer, per se. Now, you shared some. So walk us through a specific farm use case where, and what it's looked like for, you know, the value at the end of the day, both financially, time-wise, and otherwise.
Yeah, so we have a farmer in Iowa, has about 15,000 acres, has a lot of different technology solutions, uses John Deere Ops Center as Conservice, has a marketing plan, uses a lot of tools out there around basis, around farm management, around inputs, as well as having different businesses, financial tools, you know, different accounting systems. And what we talk about for him is a concept actually I learned when I was at Boeing Company early on. At the time, the military was working on a concept called network-centric warfare, where everything on the battlefield is feeding data to a center point, and that battlefield commander is making better decisions because they don't have to call and wait and source all that information. You know, when you're in a battle, it's seconds count. And so the timeliness of getting information, synthesizing it, and saying, here's the most important thing you could do, those information asymmetries are pretty significant. And so for this particular farmer, we talked about his inbox as kind of the first step to say, you got a lot of emails in your inbox you don't have time to read. And because of that, you're not making the most informed decision around perhaps negotiating an operating loan, making a purchase, doing a lease, not because the information isn't there, but it's maybe 2 hours a day he doesn't have where he could sort through everything that he's getting from land-grant universities and journals and information, different sources like that. And so he knows he's making less than optimal decisions. We put an AI to the inbox, and so let's just help to do some information arbitrage and not feel like a, you know, battlefield medic in a civil war. And if you get triaging the right information the right way and just using that, this is something we typically start every farmer on, is let's just point AI to your inbox and your sent items and start to figure out how to get a 7 a.m. newspaper or bulletin written. And this takes, you know, 10 minutes to set up just to get a handle of what you're getting hit with every day. And that from there is like, wow, this works so great. What else can I do? And that's where we started to pull farm management decisions around what's being grown, how much is being grown, how much is being spent on inputs, where are those inputs. We started to look at dispatch. We started to look at all kinds of information on the farm and giving him an interface where it's not necessarily a chat bot like a chat GPT thing. It's an actual map. It's actual plans. It's actual GPS data, stuff he already has sitting in front of him. But now he's able at 7 a.m. to get his bulletin. What emails, what meetings, what decisions? Secondly, how's my farm doing? How's it running? Then having AI go through and surface things, that's important. Also, his marketing plan. Am I making the right decisions on the markets? Being able to analyze that. And now in less than an hour, he's able to go through the 5, 6 most important things of his week, going through that in less than 30 minutes, knowing what's most important, moving on with his day. And without these tools, probably would have taken him 2 or 3 hours just to sort through all that. And that's what we're finding consistently is the number one thing that helps farmers see the benefit of this is that information arbitrage to say, I'm scanning and pulling in as much as I can, but I'm getting hit with more than I have time to go through. And so how do you make the best decisions at the right time? What we often say is making better decisions faster. And now he has a full farm dashboard, farm tool, called me the other day and said, hey, I had a split-second decision to make around rye and a shipment. It normally would have taken me 2 hours to figure it out. I was able to knock it out in less than 5 minutes and send it out the door, made some money on that. Or fertilizer decisions or market decisions. This isn't necessarily a game changer. He's not improving his yield or anything big agronomically, but he's saying all these decisions he's making better now are starting to add up for him. And he's really seeing the value there. But it all started with just, let's just get AI in your inbox, see where that's beneficial, and that's what we're doing with other farms.
Well, so I definitely see the time savings there, potentially stuff, but I know Kevin will ask, and I will too. If it's not, if this new tool is not dropping to the bottom line and adding and creating more revenue, even though it's cleaning up, I mean, does it matter? Are you seeing, do we have examples? You shared them with me about in Washington, but this Iowa guy.
Yeah.
I mean, is he dropping
so Apple Farm
to the bottom line?
Absolutely. So an apple farm we worked with out of Washington State, huge operation, dozens and dozens of farms. They're making labor decisions every hour, or I'm sorry, every week. Get in an office on Friday, sit down, go through all the labor decisions they're making and saying, hey, we should have done this differently on Tuesday. We should have made a decision differently there. And so pushing tools down to where they're making decisions by the hour. They cut out 30% of their labor costs per year, which sounds like an astronomically large number, but it was simply because when you're making decisions by the hour, starting to add up over time, you're making very different decisions and you're making them by the week. Another farm we worked with that was doing packing, they had a huge cost around packing costs, pushing numbers down to the individual. And this is just helping everyone see how they're performing against everyone else. Every individual on a packing line now can pull up their phone and saying, how am I performing? How am I doing against other people? Both of these actually, ironically, were pre-AI. They were just better decisions pushed to people's phones, pushed to people in the hour, pushed to crew bosses in the moment. But because they're making decisions every 30 minutes to an hour instead of every week, that led it into big numbers. Now our AI comes along, and we're starting to see the compounding effect as we start with helping people understand their data. An example of this grain farmer, and the decision he's making is definitely adding up. I mean, with just good data, you can make a lot of that. That's what we mentioned with tree fruit, kind of pre-AI. Good data practices allowed us to push data out by the hour using business intelligence tools. But now with AI, able to sort through all that out yourself, it absolutely is making bottom line decision making, because that timeliness of information, an example of this is a WASDE report hits every month, and if it takes me 3 hours to analyze the markets and what I need to do, I'm going to make different decisions than if I'm making it every, 5 minutes after the report launches. But that's hard for a given grain farmer to analyze and synthesize that information in 5 minutes to make a decision. But that's where a lot of the movement happens. And so quantifying it in terms of where AI is beneficial, we're absolutely starting to see it in places like this example of labor, and where if I have information that's on an hourly or sub-weekly basis, I'm absolutely going to save time and money on that. That labor example with apples, as I mentioned, started with just data, and now using AI to sort through it and make it even better decisions there. The example around disease and pests, the timeliness of decision making there. The big problem is certainly your point to quantify that sometimes. It gets lost in the minutiae of farming. But in the case with labor, it was a very clear ROI associated with that. And that's what we're trying to drive to more is seeing the incremental and gradual benefits of AI over time. But those big wins, I think, are often elusive because a lot of what we're seeing with the benefit of data and AI, it's great to hit grand slams out of the park, but we're hitting more and more singles for farms to the bottom line level. And at the end of the year, that definitely adds up.
So you're saying, it sounds like you're saying that it is obviously going to improve farm margins, but is it going to eventually become another technology cost that everyone's got to carry just to remain competitive, or will it continue to help guys bottom line?
Well, that's where we're in an interesting space around this generative AI atmosphere, because right now you hear a lot about Claude, you hear a lot about OpenAI, and you hear a term called tokens. This term's thrown around a lot. As I get charged a subscription fee, but I have these token costs, and a token is just an AI tool processing the word, and you get paid, charged by the word, basically. For these AI tools to come and sort through all that, and you're reading a lot in the news on how these AI bills are going through the roof because of the use of these models. More technologies are starting to come out now, and you're reading about this in the Wall Street Journal, what they call open weight models, which are token-free. And some do come from China, but there's also U.S.-based models as well. Given this space is so new, and it's only 2 or 3 years old, these closed models tied to for-profit companies that are all pre-IPO right now, you know, we're definitely going to see things get more expensive on the AI space. OpenAI, Claude, Anthropic, it will get more expensive as they go. But what we're also going to see is these open weight models start to get more popular, where a farmer can not only own and host their own model, but also is not something you're charged for the word by. And that, I think, right now is very hard to do. It's very hard to use an open weight model. It's very hard to host it. There's no easy button when it comes to that right now. The easy button exists on these closed source models. But it's making everyone aware this technology is really powerful if it's used in the right way. But we haven't yet flipped the switch to where farmers can own their own models at scale and start to leverage and make these decisions themselves and not be relying on these third-party companies that are really going to start to get more expensive over time. I expect that tipping point to be in the next 12 months where we start to see a lot more ag companies embracing their own models versus these out-of-the-box models from Anthropic and OpenAI, especially being both pre-IPO companies. Kind of get more expensive as we go, but it has to get a lot easier than it is now using these open weight models, and that's going to be a ways out. So that's where I see the big frontier and really adoption point comes when a farmer can pay a flat monthly fee for all the AI tools they want, make it work for them, not have to worry about this incremental spend around tokens.
Right. I learned that myself early on. Didn't know what was going on when they told me I had to pay more money for the slot machine. So funny stuff.
Yep.
Hey, so farmers have repeatedly adopted technology while productivity and economic benefit seems to flow elsewhere. My question is, who ultimately is going to capture the value from AI and ag? Is it going to be the farmer, input company, equipment manufacturer, anyone in the supply chain, or is this going to stay as there's going to be value for the farmer using this as he has his own data? Maybe now all of a sudden they can collect data and put it and sell it themselves instead of it being sent through John Deere ops and stuff. Or paint that picture for us.
Yeah, so traditionally, it's a sad state. Certainly, as growing up in specialty crops, it feels like the farmer's the last one to get the benefit, but the first one to get the bill. You have a lot of sophisticated players when it comes to buying apples, for example. Well, Walmart has a very sophisticated team for spot price commodities, and these farmers who are growing and selling the apples don't have the same power that Walmart does to negotiate with a fair prices. And a large part of what caused me to pivot out of high tech, to get an ag, to do data play, is I want to help even the playing field when it comes to who benefits from these tools. AI, as it stands today, is pretty technical. It's pretty difficult. Like I said, there's no easy button. And so you see the big guys, the ABCDs of the world, definitely embracing it. You see speculators embracing it, traders. A lot of the traditional folks that go heavy into tech early on, but a lot of the folks that are hedging or growing, the ones in the farm gate, where do they start? In a rural community. Not every community has an AI guy like they have a lawyer or a CPA. So the whole point of our firm is to get training and education and tools out there so everyone in ag can benefit from leveraging us early on, and farmers not having to wait 10 or 20 years to really jump on board when everyone else is jumping on board now, because AI isn't going away. It's not a fad. There's a bit of a bubble, I think, around how these guys are priced, but it's a tech that's going to last a long time. There's just not a lot of accessibility getting every farmer out there aware of how to use it, how to jump into it, and how to get the most benefit from it. And that's why our firm exists, a large part. I hope other firms like ours continue to exist and grow, because it's a huge opportunity when used the right way to keep it affordable, to maintain it, to build the right systems. There's a lot of ways to use it wrong, a lot of ways to use it expensively, but keeping the right price, doing it the right way, I think more and more folks are seeing the benefit to jump into it. But I think we just need more tech education and training and coaching and tools out there, leading in on, you know, FFA chapters, or I'm an adjunct at NC State here in North Carolina and in Raleigh, where we live now, trying to continue to emphasize the need to just get more tools in the hands of farmers so they do equally benefit. Because I think left to the industry's own devices in the supply chain, they seem to be the last one to really jump on board, not for lack of desire. But it's a complicated thing from the get-go. And so the people that can hire the tech people tend to win first, and trying to bring it into a place where every farmer can access and learn from it. And I think there's a huge, huge opportunity to jump on board now, understand it, and use it in the business. It is so new still, but 10 years from now, when it's fully commoditized and everyone else is using it, the ag tech companies, supply chain folks, brokers, you know, procurement organizations, they will already be well adopting it, as a lot of farmers start to embrace it themselves early on. So as we can drive more awareness, more education, more adoption, more questions from the farmers themselves, I think it would be a great opportunity to even that playing field a little bit more than what's traditionally been the case with new technology.
So with this technology, is there a specific type of farmer operation, you know, the largest, the best capitalized, or who has the cleanest data that's going to benefit from all this more than anybody?
Yeah. So I think there's three different groups of people. In one category, you have farms that already invest in tech people, that are developers, that are sysadmins, you know, a local IT operation, encouraging those folks to really get on board and start to learn these tools. A lot of concerns around security, around owning your own data, around the cost. All those concerns can be alleviated by leaning in and starting to get smart about these tools. So farm organizations using a third-party IT supplier, maybe someone inside their own operation they've had for a while, really emphasizing learning these tools and starting small and understanding how to use it. You have a second category of farms that don't have tech people, that aren't, you know, using data warehousing or anything like that. Now is a great time to start in building some competency within your organization, reaching out to organizations like ours. You know, we never charge for questions, just to answer how to get started with that stuff. But there's also so much great tools and resources online, ironically, using these AI tools for $20 a month to be able to say, hey, here's the business I'm in. What should I do to get going? And leverage these AI tools to get smart. The third category of organizations that are much bigger, already leaning in on AI and starting to leverage that. You know, being able to do community events, reach out to the area, somewhat of a distinct competitive advantage to have an edge in AI, but encouraging those larger organizations to support training and education within the broader community. I think now is an opportunity to link arms within the agricultural space in America and really start to emphasize, you know, one person knowing it over anyone else benefits them, certainly, but everyone getting smart about this benefits us all. And I think there's a fit for AI in every size farm. Different farms will certainly embrace it differently, but the opportunity to incorporate education, awareness, and training for everyone to start in and saying, I know there's a way I can leverage AI. How do I do it? Where do I start? Maybe grow some internal competency around best practices for data leading up to using AI is also a good idea as well, and really trying to solve for that, you know, battlefield medic scenario in the Civil War, and that I feel like AI is helping me save time, think straight, not be stressed. And if you're making better decisions faster, using AI to solve some of those fundamental issues we all have, just keeping up on things, you know, builds from there. And every farm can benefit from that.
100% agree on that. We've repeatedly said over time that, you know, most new technology simply amplifies the strengths and weaknesses already present. I mean, are you going to make any claims that AI is a magic bullet, or would that go true with AI as well, in the manner in which you're using it?
I think it's going to be, if I am an ag organization that's prone not to jump on a new technology or treat technology like a fad or say, man, I don't have time for that, that distinction is going to be much more articulate than it ever has been before. You can get by previously without having a data warehouse. You can get by previously without having business intelligence, maybe even having a website for a farm. And that isn't as noticeable as it will be not using AI. I think it's as big of a deal as going from manually harvesting wheat to using a tractor, right? And it took a while, certainly, but no one would go back and say, you know, we should really harvest our greens by hand again because these combines aren't really working out for us. And I feel like what I'm starting to see folks leaning in hard on using AI, it's becoming a very stark difference to those that aren't there yet, more so than maybe the last 20 or 30 years around technology, and seeing companies like Emergent Connects, passive data collection using IoT devices, you know, what they're starting to do, providing sensors into farms and using that passive data collection, leading in with JD Ops data, managing that more effectively, having AI attack your inbox, having AI help you with QuickBooks. Those advantages build quick. And AI, I think, is absolutely a tsunami, but you're either going to be on the beach or grabbing a surfboard. And the difference between those who do and don't, I think, is going to be more pronounced than, you know, like I say, the last several years of technology adoptions. And it will highlight those that lean in and ones that don't. And the more advantage you get around getting good, clean data now to get ready for that, leaning in more about where AI fits, to your point you made earlier, where is it hitting the bottom line? It takes some work to get there right now. It's not obvious and saying, oh, everyone should use AI to this to save X percent. A lot of ag tech companies go out and promise that in the form of more bushels per acre, better, you know, nitrogen infusion, whatever else. This is about hitting a lot of singles that over the course of a season get you more runs in the gate versus, you know, everyone's going to be a grand slam. And those advantages will build up over time. I think for anyone now that leans in versus those that don't, that's where you're going to start to see the difference.
So would you agree then that potentially AI could accelerate consolidation by giving larger farmers, you know, the better systems and lower overhead and faster access to capital?
Absolutely. I mean, it's going to help anyone amplify advantages they already have. And your point around folks that have big tech, that already have good, clean data, they're already leveraging their information effectively today, that use those as asymmetric advantages, AI is going to accelerate that. And we're starting to see this from large farm organizations that are going all in with AI and saying, you know, from top down, this is something we need to focus on. And that's where I think it's important that every farmer anywhere gets a handle on this stuff, because the advantage does typically go to those that are best capitalized, that are best prepared, that already have the team, already have the data tools. AI is going to greatly enhance and extend that. Ones that don't are going to be further behind. And that's where I think anyone anywhere can start to leverage these tools now and get a lead on how it benefits them. They won't be left in worse shape, because the folks that embrace it and get the benefits of that, you know, traditionally large farms that have the ability to hire the people and do the teams, and it's just going to get more pronounced than it was before. But it's not to say it takes a lot of capital or it takes a lot of investment to use AI for any size farm or any size farming operation. You just got to start, dive in, reach out to folks that want to help and get smart about it. And that will make that advantage less pronounced than if you hold off or, you know, wait for a better time.
Yeah. Now, for those that don't know, we've recently partnered with a company called Emergent Connects, and they're doing a lot of stuff in the space. Did you tell me that you had some, that you were involved in that process?
Yeah. So DataPlay has been a long-term partner of Emergent Connects. We helped with some of the AI tools and data infrastructure there, and partnering with them. They provide passive data collection through the IoT network, through sensor data, but they're the water main, and we jokingly say we're the plumbers. So water's great up until it doesn't make it in your house, and you need to build the sinks and the tools. So DataPlay comes along and takes it the last mile into the farm, help set all that up and put it to use. And so Emergent and DataPlay have been good partners working with that. We worked with them early on to help with out some of their AI capabilities. And now they're off and going on their own and doing great stuff. But we partner well long-term with our customers because, you know, all the AI in the world doesn't matter if you don't have all the right data. And all the data doesn't matter if you're not putting it to use.
That's pretty simply and well said. Let me throw it over. Kevin, have you got any questions for Dan?
Yeah, Dan, what would you say, what are the top three things that producers could be doing out there today, row crop producers, and using AI to improve their bottom line?
I'd say number one thing is to do an inventory of the data they have on their farm today. whether it's pivots, whether it's, you know, JD ops, whether it's, you know, whatever data they have today, and saying, what part of this data do I not have the time to go through, maximize its usefulness, or something I feel like I need to hire a guy just to sort it out for me. Start with that 2 a.m. list of issues. Here's the top 10 things that are causing me heartache. Where can I start to understand how data and these decisions are going to help me drive a better outcome? And how do I get AI to help me there, right? And that doesn't require you to hire a person. Doesn't require a lot of investment. It's simply spending 2 or 3 hours getting smart about an AI tool, taking that data and putting it to work, and starting to wrestle a little bit with how to make use of that. The second thing is investing in good data infrastructure is the best way to start. The more of your data on the farm that's in a spot AI can access it, the better off you're going to be putting that data to work. I mean, it's great to start with your inbox. Better to have everything on your farm, everything in your operation in one spot, putting it to use. And the third thing is making it a part of each day where you're learning about something about AI, reading an article, getting smart about the space. Even if you're not someone that's going to jump all in with it now, getting smarter about it, making it less of an unknown or less of a black box is only going to help you out, because everyone that's pitching you now, AI is going to be part of the pitch. All the products and services and ag retailers you work with, AI is going to get incorporated. You're going to read a lot more about it in the news. It's going to be a lot more part of everyone's portfolio. And so I think demystifying it, better understanding it, and really sorting out where it fits for you and where it doesn't is probably the most important thing. So putting your data to work, find one use case to start. Second is starting with a tool, getting smarter about how to put that to work, and getting better educated around that. And then the third is just diving in, learning about it, and demystifying it for yourself.
Yeah, that's all good. It sounds like a big infomercial for AI, but give me some real points here. Like, what are you guys hearing? What are you seeing on the farm? What are people coming up with that are actually making a difference for them on the farm? I mean, like you said, that first thing, find out where you've got your data, where it's causing you pain. Okay, what is it? Where is it causing pain? I mean, where are you seeing that people are like, whoa, I really should have been looking in this area under the hood at this particular carburetor here, and this is the problem. You see what I'm saying? What are the big problems that people are coming up with?
Yeah, so three good examples off the top of my head. Working with one specialty crop farmer. He recently travels a lot. He's working with soy all over the world, travels a lot on his farm. But he's out on the road because he's not always there. It's hard for him to keep up on the decisions he needs to make on a farm. And he's a next-generation farmer, so knows a lot about it. But it's that thing I mentioned earlier about information arbitrage around, I got 10 minutes to go through my inbox. I have 10 minutes to sort through what's on my farm. He's only going to solve the most pressing issues, but a lot of stuff doesn't get dealt with in the moment. He has a hard time not having a second brain to sort through what he consistently needs to focus on and how to focus on it. So he's using AI right now to go through all of his farm intel. His information is in box, and when he gets up in the morning saying, what's the most important things I need to do, and training a model to actually think like him. So it's not just, you know, what's most expensive or what's most important. As he's making decisions and sorting through information, he's a model that's learning that. So things like him, more and more over time, helps him make better decisions. And he said it absolutely is the most important thing of his day, because it avoids him missing, you know, stuff that, quote unquote, a normal tool might miss. But he just knows what to look for and how to look for it. And now he has a tool that works the same way. Second situation is a grain farmer called me up the other day and said, hey, I needed to make a decision on a shipment. I needed to know how much rye I've harvested, how much I have, how much is available. He had 5 or 6 different decisions to make. And normally it would have taken him making phone calls, digging into information, sorting stuff out in an hour or two. Trucks were there, ready to get going. He had 10 minutes to turn it around. He used AI to go through, sort through all those pieces of information and make a faster decision. So for him, he's like, hey, it's an opportunity cost. I could have spent the time, made the calls, done the thing, but this allowed me to get out to where I needed to go quickly, send the trucks out in a different direction they would have gone otherwise, you know. And that timeliness of putting it all in, sorting it out, helping to make a decision fast. It's also the guy that benefits from, we talked earlier about marketing plans. It's just when the markets move, he wants to be better informed quickly on what he needs to do, using AI to help him with that. So second use case there is just timeliness of information. Third example, I mentioned that large farm around labor decisions. So they make big decisions every week, and they pull all the data in from all the farms. They sit down as a leadership team, and they sort through what decisions they made around labor and what decisions they should have made. But pushing it down and sorting through that to crew bosses in the moment who aren't necessarily the most informed holistically, perhaps, you know, don't speak English really well, they'll make gut reactions in the moment but aren't as informed as they should be around how the decisions they make affects the farm as a whole, nor can they have a management team just sitting there with each one of their crew bosses to making decisions too. So it can synthesize how harvest is going, push down a decision and make better decisions and empower those beneath you that normally wouldn't be making the right decisions around things like labor and crews and teams. There's just not the right number of managers to sort out every issue every step of the way. And so it gets to the end of the week and they're like, hey, here's all the places we need to train and teach better inform. Now we can push that data out in the hour to the team, having a system in place. So they're just pushing the, and basically delegating decision-making with better information down to folks that normally wouldn't make decisions. So that's been a huge deal for them.
All right. What? So you're saying some people are using this to help them with their grain marketing, I guess. Maybe.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yep.
That's interesting.
Huh. Yeah. I mean, not every farmer is an economist, and I feel like there are folks that will hand the decisions off to someone that is more of an expert or will look at it themselves to make decisions, but where you can take and train a model that can think more like an economist and having experience there around those decision makings. It might be decisions you make otherwise. It might be decisions you rely someone else on, but kind of this, I have an expert in my looking at my farm, looking at my marketing and helping me make better decisions or at least give me better information about things I should think about. We're doing this in partnership with an ag resource company that has the expertise and then working with a handful of grain farms to make that available to their farms, but not so much broad advice that's, you know, in the form of a newsletter or something in broad strokes, but more, can you look at my specific marketing plan, my specific farm, and tell me maybe things I should do differently? And that's typically inaccessible or expensive, but it's what we call hyper-personalization or hyper-contextualization. If I can take all this broad advice and personalize it for my farm, I'm going to benefit from that.
Yeah, we've invested, you know, hell, we were early at the advent of online trading. We were at the forefront of online trading. Then we became early investors in AI models into trading, and I, you know, we've never seen anything good that me and my friend, human traders, that we couldn't beat ourselves pretty easily. And that's why I am always of the contention. I don't see AI taking over the trading world in any capacity, just because I mean, hell, I got to be of the belief if AI is going to, the models are going to all make similar moves if that's the right answer, the quote, right answer at the moment. And if all the models are making similar moves, the market isn't the market, and all of a sudden the market's broken, insanely broken. And so I'd be extremely hesitant to use AI in a big, big way on my marketing. I mean, that's just me.
I totally agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And to put a caveat in there, I don't advocate that AI is going to replace anyone in that way. I say it's an exoskeleton and not a robot. If you're not at all aware or informed on how to do things like trading, this isn't going to do it for you. But what we're finding is for folks that are less in the know, having a tool that knows their farm, giving them advice, helps them have better conversations with traders, helps them be better informed. They're not going to replace the need for a trader or the need for that tool, but it's raising the bar around, I'm going to take generic information that contextualizes on my operation. Now I'm just better informed as a grower what to do. But it's not going to replace the need.
Yeah, I could see that. I mean, I could argue both sides of that, because I just heard Todd ask me a series of what I thought were kind of silly questions that I'm sure he put into AI. They told him to ask me those questions about trading in the market. But if he's over there following that, he's going to be lost over in the weeds. And that's my only thing. That is my only thing. It's like you are arming some people with some information that now they think they are smart. The most dangerous thing, I'm just going to tell you, the most dangerous thing I've seen in my life are people who were lucky, Dan. They were in the right place at the right time. They had a little luck hit them, and all of a sudden they thought they were smart. And I'm telling you, that shit gets dangerous, and I'm not so sure AI might not provide that to some folks. And then all of a sudden they think they're smart, and they're making some crazy moves. And so I don't know.
100%.
Still kind of sitting there like, and I'm with you. I do use AI, and I think a lot of people on the farms are using it to help get more informed and better intel to make better decisions, like you said, and speed up your decision-making process and to do things.
Right.
And that's going to be, like you're saying, that's going to be different for every producer on every operation. And that's why to hold you down and pin you down to, like, what are the one or two things, I don't think is really fair. Because I'm with you, I think it is going to be different for everybody. But, you know, I think you just got to find that. I think everybody's got to find those holes in their current, you know, their current process, right?
I totally agree with you. I feel like the AI industry has given everyone an F-16 with no flight school, and that's dangerous. I mean, everyone has a jet, and nobody knows how to fly it, and we're seeing accidents. We're seeing bad stuff. We're seeing farmers vibe coding. We're seeing apps getting built. We're seeing people that are like, I can do my own development now, and have no idea the risk that comes with that. There's security holes. I mean, you still need developers to develop. A farmer cannot build their own software and expect AI did it well. And that's where I feel like everyone just got a plane, started flying it, and
that's
it's dangerous.
That's a great analogy. You are right.
100%. I'm there with you. And this is honestly why I do data play. Is I want to fix that for as many people as I can. I'm not trying to sell snake oil. There's a right way to do it, but I want to teach flight school. I want everyone to know how to fly it, how not to fly it, how to avoid crashing it. But there's not enough of me, and there's a lot more OpenAI and Anthropic and all this stuff, and farmers are beating me to the punch, and it's not good.
And Todd, isn't that why we were talking to Dan about getting Dan and maybe Carter as well to – have a bolt-on conference for people that are interested in going to flight school on AI and learning how to not shoot themselves in the foot or do something crazy, and, you know, have Dan maybe put the guardrails and help people and help myself. Hell, I want to go to a class with Dan and learn myself. And you know, so I'm not as dangerous and getting goofy things going on mine. So yeah, I think those are all things that we'd love to expand on, Dan, moving forward with people. So, sure.
Yeah, I want to help everyone do it the right way, and there's so many wrong ways to do it. And it's a complicated tool. It's a messy tool, and I totally agree with you. It's everyone feeling like, man, I built my own app. I'm my own developer, and I work with Carter very closely. Another good example of this, a farmer down in Arizona built an app himself, but he's like, this is the app I want. I don't trust AI that this works. Can you fix it for me? So I took his app that he vibe coded and productionalized it for him, but that probably cut 70% of the time out I would have had to spend building it for him. So here's an example where he used it, knows what he had, knows what he isn't, a developer, but said, no, this probably saved us a bunch of time working together, and it did, because I knew exactly what he wanted. I just had to do the work. AI didn't to get it done, right? And that's what I feel like with marketing, for example. A farmer shouldn't feel like, oh, I'm my own trader now, but if AI can help you become smarter to work with the trader more effectively, there's a win-win. But you got to know the right way to use it.
Yeah. For like, and for everybody listening, for like us on the iSelect side with Carter, you know, Carter's using AI to, you know, we're pouring in all of the back, you know, all of the pitch decks, all of the companies that have come wanting funding and early startups, were pouring all their business models, all their, you know, the reporting, all of their data in, and trying to conclude and find, you know, what are some of the really key elements in each that have helped make them successful, and what are some of the key elements we're finding in each that have been you know, part of companies that have failed and the many that have failed. So, yes, I agree. That is a great tool for doing it. It would take, hell, it would take 3 years to look and analyze it and compare all those different ways and variables. So, no, I think, yeah, there are tons and tons of ways that it's going to be helpful and useful on the farm. I think producers are still trying to understand where and how and, you know, how can I – test all these seeds, or how can I come up with a better decision-making process for what inputs to buy, what I need, what I don't need, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, I think it's more you're only as smart as the questions you're able to ask and understand, you know, correct. And so I think a lot of farmers are just trying to figure out what the hell questions do I even ask? What am I even wanting to know? And I think a lot of people are just stymied right there. So I don't know.
No, I think it's spot on. I go to a lot of talks, and they never charge a speaking fee. I want to give this away. I want to help people ask the right first question. And I'm a horrible businessman in that regard, because I often tell people a lot of things they shouldn't use AI for more than I do to use AI for, because I think it serves its purpose in a certain way. But there's a lot of stuff that doesn't need AI at all. Maybe it's just better data. Maybe it's just a different tool. You know, where does AI get used and how to even start with that thing? And I feel like there's a lot of folks selling snake oil or out there getting overly ambitious with it or baking it into their ag tech tools that don't fully understand the right way and wrong way to use it. That's going to get a lot of folks a big bill or a lot of trouble. And all I'm trying to do to start with is get out and just awareness and education. Just to help people understand where AI fits, where it doesn't, because where it fits really well. Like in this example with this Arizona farmer, but he also knew where it didn't fit. And that's where we had a great back and forth and helped him out there. But it's hard to sort out unless you've been there a while and worked on it in the space. And a lot of AI people don't know ag and ag people on AI. So we're kind of filling an interesting niche there. But, you know, it's going to – folks will get more informed as you go, but a lot of people are going to get in their jet and – crashing into a tree, and that's what we're going to hear about. And that's what we're out there trying to help people avoid as much as possible.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. Todd, I'll let you go back. Yeah, that's great.
Man. Yeah, no, I was done, Dan. I wanted to make sure that I was always like to leave our guests with the last word, make sure that anything that wasn't said that needs to be said, because at the end of the day, this whole purpose, and I really appreciate Kevin. I know what Kevin's trying to do and get down to the, you know, where's the real value side of it. I think we're just making this tool aware of what it is and what it can and can't do, and it may not be the sexiest thing in the world, but I think it's going to be a valuable tool for those that know how to use it. Dan, what did we not discuss or say today that needs to be said, if there is any?
I think just reemphasizing the point, the number one way in which everyone can use AI today is pick an information or data source you don't have time or don't have the ability to sort through today. Leverage AI to get smarter about it, to sort through that information. Great example around iSelect, going through PowerPoint decks. We worked with an organization that wanted the entire USDA, 42 departments, 150 million rows of data. Would have taken 6,000 man hours just going through 150 years of NAS, 50 years of WASD, Excel files, PDFs. We knocked it out in 38 hours, got the entire repo in there, validated it all, and built them a graph database, a USDA librarian. And now they're putting all that data to use. It was manual. It was hard. Nobody wanted to spend 6,000 hours to do it. Now they knocked it out in a week, right? That's a great use of AI. And now they have the value of pulling all that great stuff out there and building information and reports around 50 years of WASD and everything else. So finding a way like that, you know, low impact to the business, high effort, something that potentially is high value, but it's not something that's going to make or break your company. Great way to start. Something that takes a lot of effort, a lot of, you know, work. Can't justify the cost of doing it. Great use of AI. And start somewhere to just start to learn the tool, get the value of it, and before you know it, you know, you're going to have that digital muscle built and being able to understand where it fits, where it doesn't, and what to do with it. And that, I think, for all of us, getting smarter about AI and where it fits and where it doesn't is the best thing we could do. We all need to go to flight school. That's what I'd advise everyone today. Figure out what that looks like for you.
And if I heard you correctly earlier, you basically do discovery calls at no charge of folks, meaning if folks call you, you talk to them and at least clear their head about what direction you need to go?
Yeah, I try to give as much as I can away while also staying in business. So we do a lot of free talks, free workshops. I talk to co-ops, I talk to national boards, go to conferences. I don't charge speaking fees for that because I just want everyone better informed of the right way to use it, what to do, and that sort of thing. Discovery calls are no cost. I have a question. I just want to ask someone, you know, give me a call. I think at some point in the world, we have as many tech people like me as we have lawyers and CPAs in rural communities, but, you know, we're not there yet. So anything I can do in the ag community to just help folks get smarter about this stuff, use it the right way at the right price, make better decisions with it and not, you know, crash their plan into a tree. And that's what I want to do for folks. That's why we exist.
Where can they reach you at? I know DataPlay, maybe spell it for us or give us the websites folks can go to. They can call me, email me as well. We can push you in a direction, but where can they reach you at?
Yeah, Dan at DataPlay. It's DataPlay.com. So play on words there. And feel free to email me. Our website, DataPlay.com. You can find me on LinkedIn as well, Dan Maycock, or talk to the great folks here on the call, and you guys can get in touch as well. And then we're also talking about FarmCon, start to do flight school and get that out there as well, which I think will be a lot of fun.
Now, looking forward to that, working with you. We're looking forward to having you at FarmCon, and you and I will be working more closely to get this bolt-on conference organized and hopefully put out together early next year after FarmCon. So, Dan Maycock, thank you so very much.
Thank
appreciate
you.
Your time and insight.
Absolutely. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, buddy. All right.
Yeah.